It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
We're not afraid here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and we have Butler Schaefer's professor of law at, you know, how big a school is Southwestern Law School? How many students do you have there?
We're just a little over 1,000 students. We're having a new class that's just starting up this fall. I don't know what the entering class is, but it's generally around 1,000.
So enough. I mean, you know, we're getting some good minds out of there, and you have a great reputation around the country. 33 years doing this. Now this is what, you know, right after, there's a letter that's dated October 19th, 2001, right after 9/11, from Butler Schaefer, and there's an excerpt from it here. One positive feature of the post-September 11th mess has been the discovery of who is and who is not devoted to individual liberty. It's all so easy to espouse liberty principles when there are no apparent costs associated with doing so. It becomes much tougher when the costs begin to escalate. And I'm of the mind that we're looking at this entire thing, this entire human experiment on this planet. And, you know, it's different manifestations around the world. Certainly here in America, we had a lot of hope. And I'm going, you know, what is it that we are looking to accomplish as human beings, as we strive to be more something? You know, what do you think the highest ideal is? We find it in, well, maybe science fiction and poetry and different literature. And the most common man thing that I use, because I'm, you know, probably more common than most, is that it's manifest in blockbuster movies. You know, the movies that I see, that the big, giant, oh my goodness, blockbusters, you know, like, you know, the Avatars and the Bravehearts and the Matrix and Gladiator and, you know, on and on and on. It's all about the individual against the collective. It's always about somebody trying to subject others to their authority, and we are supportive. It's hardwired in us that we cheer for those that are being oppressed, as opposed to, even when you got, you know, a military state like Spartan, you know, you're always cheering for them when it's the Persians coming after them. So, you know, this is something. There's what is it that we are destined to be? And you've written a lot of books. And give us a couple of your favorite books and what the theme is, and where do you think humanity is going?
Well, I think the book that I still feel closest to in terms of developing my ideas is my first book, which is Calculated Chaos. The subtitle is The Institutional Threats to Peace and Human Survival. And it deals with the whole process of institutionalization, of how we take organizations that work. We're social beings. We need to organize with one another. We wouldn't make it very effectively in the world if we tried to do it alone. Hermits don't really live well. They even tend to kind of go off in the hills of Montana and become Unabombers and so on, because all they do is end up talking to themselves. They don't have that interplay with other people to kind of keep them human.
We're going to go on this line of thinking, this line of thought. We get into a larger segment when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with Butler Schaefer. You know, where is humanity destined? Well, you don't even... How would you even know if you haven't even started to think about it? He has.
I'll call you right back.
It's time to declare your independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443. And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Butler Schaefer. Butler Schaefer is the man. Butler Schaefer is a professor at Southwestern Law School in Southern California, professor of law there, training young minds to be, you know, like my good friend Mark Victor. That's how I got to know Butler years ago is, you know, because, yeah, Mark is a unique individual. He's a criminal defense attorney here, my partner on the Freedom Summit, and we have a very interesting relationship. We're good friends, but, I mean, dang, you messed that boy up for the rest of his life. and it was, here's someone that was, you know, he's Republican, yeah, and he was in the Marines! He was a Desert Storm. He's coming. And all of a sudden, you have this professor that really just kept asking him questions, and he's having to re-examine his entire life of whatever was planted in his brain. And you're getting back to some core common axiom, some kind of common truth, some kind of common, you know, ground that where you could both agree on what is the truth, and then you can build from there. And I'm just wondering what that is, and if you could address that, and go ahead and finish, you know, talking about your favorite book, Calculated Chaos, and let's go ahead and go where humanity's going, and I'm kind of, let's start off with Mark, and kind of where do you find common ground with people like that that are interested? They do want to know the truth. So you, where's the common ground? What are you looking for?
Well, I don't know that I'm really looking for anything as much as I'm just desirous of kind of putting a lot of these ideas out there. And once you put them out there, once you've said something on the air that people listen to, they've heard that idea. They've heard it once, and it may be very shocking, very radical, very strange to them. But at some other time, sometime later on, they're going to hear that same idea expressed by somebody else. And then they're going to hear it a third time, and then a fourth time. And by the time they get down to about the fourth time, they're going to start thinking that that's my idea. I always thought that way. You know, it's just a process that we all go through. I can recall the early days of the so-called libertarian thinking. I was teaching out at the Freedom School and Rampart College out in Colorado, and this was in the mid-60s. And Bob LaFave ran that school and was able to get people to come out there and spend 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Listening to an intensive program on the concept of liberty, a very property-oriented concept. But during those days, and this is not an exaggeration, people who would characterize themselves as libertarians, and I might add, there was a long time we even tried to figure out what we even call ourselves. And what are we, individualists? Are we conservatives? Are we libertarians? Are we this? Are we that? What are we? Objectivists? Whatever. But the people who would characterize themselves as libertarians were the kind of people who knew each other. Maybe not personally, maybe not they hadn't physically met, but they knew each other by name. So that you were to tell a friend, you know, I'm going back to Cleveland this week. So you're going to Cleveland? I said, yeah. Well, be sure and look up Joe Schmo. Well, who's Joe Schmo? Well, he's our libertarian back in Cleveland. We've got a libertarian in Cleveland. When people hear that, they think, "Well, I'm just exaggerating." That's not the case. Murray Rothbard once said that there was a time when all the people who were libertarians could meet in his apartment in New York, and his apartment in New York was rather small, as most apartments are. But he was right. There was a time when the people who shared this point of view were just few and far between.
Why was it so with that kind of, I don't know if it's positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement, the fact that you were just not even alone was enough positive reinforcement for people that, you know they're right, certainly in their own minds. But I'm just, from that humble beginning, how is it that you were able to have the confidence to keep going? What was it that made you so confident you were right?
There were a number of influences. One, a very great influence on me But in addition to Bob LaFave, was Ayn Rand. And she served as a wonderful catalyst for my thinking, even though the basis of her thinking I reject. I mean, the idea that there are objective values is silly. All values, by definition, are subjective. We can get into that sometime. But the one thing that she did, actually she did, I think, two things that she ought to be commended for. One is she smacked collectivism right in the chops at a time when it was just very impolitic, very politically incorrect to do so. You know, collectivism was just an accepted way of doing things. You know, you think in terms of the utilitarian principle, the greatest good for the greatest number, and the democratic process is a way of deciding that, et cetera. And Rand came along and said, no, this is just all collectivism that just militates against the individual. And I think this sort of sunk in with a lot of people. And her works helped people like myself and others to begin questioning the nature of the systems that we're operating under.
You know, this is it brings to mind, I graduated high school in 79. I moved out. I worked for a year. I saved money. I got ready. I went to Arizona State University. Aerospace engineering, man, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. But it's right in the middle of all the economic stuff that was going on then, and I couldn't continue my schooling. I had to go to work. Well, what happened was, as I'm going to school, I joined a fraternity. You know, the reason was because it was cheaper to live. They had all the tests, you know, filed from all the engineering professors. So I'm like, cool, I'll go here. Your entertainment was, you know, taken care of and so on. So I'm taking this serious, man. I'm into it. One of my first classes was, I think it was Philosophy 101 or whatever. And they're doing it, and you got these big auditorium classes. There's probably 300 people in there, a bunch of freshmen. Like, all right, here we go. And they had what you're talking about, you know, utilitarianism, rule utilitarianism, deontology, and all these different philosophies and so on. It basically comes down to this. The greatest good for the greatest number, or there are simple rights that you just can't ever violate, and that's just the way it is, blah, blah, blah. I wrote the paper the assignment that we had is you had to come up with a circumstance to do whatever. I came up and I go, you know, I'm thinking at the time, you know, we don't deal with terrorists. You never do this. You never, you know, take, you know, from mm-hmm. somebody else to redistribute. You never, you know, it's just, and I'm thinking, you know, that I never even heard the word libertarian. This is 1981. And I'm going, all right, I'm going to make the argument that it is always utilitarian. It's always in everyone's best interest. It's always, as time goes by, to be principled. And I make that argument, D. Yeah. D. You are so not allowed to do that. D. I was very proud of my argument. I lost all interest in any kind of higher education from that one single experience.
Did you do with your D-minus grade of that paper?
I didn't care. Screw them. I mean, the fact that I get
my point.
The fact that I got a D, I'm like, seriously? This is so that line of thinking that you would produce the most good by being principled, by defending the rights of individuals, by not, you know, taking from someone for a greater collective good, and that what it just they were. Angry. I talked to one of the student, assistant teachers, teacher assistant guys or whatever, you know, graduate students or something. And I remember going and I go to him, and he's a young guy, and he was just indignant. I mean, it was like he felt sullied by having even had to read it. And I'm mm-hmm. going, wow. So I never heard the word libertarian. It was probably 10 years later before I even heard the word libertarian. But as you said that right then, it made me think of that. And I go, oh, I get it. That was part of the indoctrination, is to weed out this kind of thought, to impact it by no positive reinforcement, by slapping it down because it was dangerous to them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And most of the people who teach in universities at that level don't even recognize that's what they're doing. They think they're dealing in some great pursuit of wonderful ideas or something of that nature. I gave a talk down at the Mises Institute about 7 years ago. I think it was March of 2003, if my memory is correct. And the title of it was A Cost-Benefit Analysis of the Human Spirit. And you know, if anyone is interested in reading that, it's that they can find it at lewrockwell.com, Lou with an L-E-W, lewrockwell.com, and click on where it says columnist and then go to my name. And you can find that article, and it was, or the paper, but it was turned into an article. And basically it was an elaboration of this whole notion that the most pragmatic, the most practical way of doing things has to be measured against all of the costs associated with doing it. And there are costs that go beyond simply the material, monetary, physical costs. There are costs associated with moral and ethical values, with emotions, with other kinds of principles, which...
Okay, yeah, remember where you're at right there, Butler. They're going to push the button on us. You know, we'll go ahead and get right back with Butler Schaefer.
You've got to control that button, Ernie.
All right. Hey, we'll be back in just a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and the annoyed Butler Schaefer. We always got to chop this thing up. You know, at the bottom of the hour, Butler, we get into a long 18-minute one, so we can rant and roll all we want on that one. Now, you were talking about the cost-benefit analysis of the human spirit, an article on Lou Rockwell. What I'm going to do is we already have it up on today's archive for today's show. We have all the Lincoln goodies for Butler Schaefer, so you won't miss anything. So we're going to put this up. Now, go ahead and finish your thoughts, sir.
The point was that there are all kinds of costs associated with what we do. And in an institutionalized world, institutions are only interested in those costs that can be quantified, the ones that can be measured in some concrete monetary or statistical fashion. And I got into a discussion one time with an economist of very, very strong libertarian persuasion, but he was giving a presentation on economics that was focusing solely on quantifiable costs. And I asked him about some of the costs that can't be quantified, and he was wondering what I had in mind, and I said, say, the cost of an Auschwitz. What are the costs of an Auschwitz? And this man happened to be Jewish, and so I think it hit him particularly in an important way. And he just finally admitted, he said, you're right. He said, but as economists, we just can't talk about that. And I said, well, I think that maybe we ought to learn how to start talking about that. And that's one of the things I got into in this paper that I gave on the cost-benefit analysis. We need a new language by which our inner voices can communicate with the outside world. And so far, we haven't done that. You know, we don't do a very good job of it. I think the Austrian economists, the people that you see with the Mises Institute, have done this quite well. I mean, we recognize that contrary to the collectivist point of view that sees things as a simply of an institutionally driven set of values, the Austrians say, no, we are individually self-interest motivated, self-interest driven. I remember a conference that my friend Cy Leon put on a number of years ago. He had two speakers there talking on terms of economic policy. One, his name slips my mind right now, but he was what you would call an institutional economist. The other economist was Harry Brown. The institutional economist had a group of maybe five or six people who came to see him because they were meeting at the same time in different rooms. Harry Brown's group was standing room only, literally. People were standing out in the hall to hear Harry. What was the difference? Well, Harry was an individual economist, not a collective one. And I think there are a lot of people who are seeing through this this film of collectivism by which they've been trained and conditioned and so forth to see yourself and be all you can be in the army, you know?
You know, this is one point that is good to make right there, is that you have the institutions protecting the institutional type thinking about institutional economics.
Right.
And so what attracts the Krugmans and the Reich and the all these collective economic guys that, and getting Nobel Peace Prizes, by the way. So these guys, all these people that are in support of the institution of somebody being in charge up top to turn a dial, to change a number, to create, because like you're saying, they're not looking at the Auschwitz. They're not looking at the damage of what's done to individual motivations to even want to make the money. You know, they're just thinking, we'll go out with this. And then we have a long segment when we come back, just to warn you, they're going to push the button in about a minute and a half anyway.
Yeah, but just look at the way in which business organizations, for example, and governments deal with people. What are people called in a business organization? Human resources. Think of that. You're a human resource. Along with the cattle, along with all the cotton balls, everything else, whatever it is that we need to exploit to turn from one form into another in order to maximize profits for our organization, human beings are part of that, and they're just resources available.
Well, you know, successful companies, oftentimes, it's not just the terminology. It's the thought process behind it. They'll see them as partners. They see them as contractors. They see them as shared interest in some way, voluntary contract, temporary alliance, association, common interest, kind of as negotiating for their labor and skills and talents to produce a blah, blah, blah. It's a totally different way of thinking, and it's more productive. It is more, but it's less controllable. It's less centralized. It's less, one guy gets to turn one dial and have an effect, even though it may kill the goose that lays the golden egg. But dang it, the golden eggs wasn't even really the priority for a lot of guys. I just want to have a control of the goose.
Yeah,
you know?
This change in the way of thinking is the way when I was engaged in law practice, I was representing management and labor problems. And this is the way we taught our clients, you've got to decentralize management. You've got to have what we call participatory management, where you bring the employees in as part of the decision-making process.
But then they would have some power. We can't give them the power. We have a long segment coming up, 18 minutes. Got big, 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 giant segment. Butler and I, he can share his thoughts at length when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. And I'm going to be, some observations I had when I met Art Laffer. That's going to be a laugh.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Butler Schaefer. Butler Schaefer, law professor from Southwestern Law College. You know, this is a real treat that I get to talk to someone that, at least understands the words that come out of my mouth, and can even, kind of drag me off even further down the rabbit hole. This is a Southwestern Law School. I got to ask this question real quick. Are they supportive of you being there, or more than just tolerated? Are people like signing up for your class, or your class is packed, or you got three people in them? I mean, what's going on?
Out looking for a job, and I made application to come teach here. I would not be hired. No, I'm not of the politically correct stripe, but I'm tolerated. I do my work. I think I do a good job of helping students learn what they're supposed to be learning in my class, and that is, basic concepts that.
My question is because it, certainly in from your writings on Lou Rockwell, people that know who you are in the Love Evolution from the Ron Paul campaign in 2008, and speaking at the Freedom Summit, I was really surprised at how many young people. are like your roadies. I mean, it was amazing to me that you have so much support out here, and I'm just wondering if that was transferred into the classroom, or are they just so, by the time they get, one, just wanting to be a lawyer to begin with, they got issues right there. But, you know, I'm, you know, so they coming in and they're like, oh, you know, that Butler Schaefer, the crazy one, you know, I gotta take his class. Or are they looking forward to coming to class? Because when I see you speak out here in the real world, I mean, you're a rock star. What's up?
Well, yeah, catch me with my guitar sometime. I should get one of those. Is it the Kiss group that I see in commercials? That they're
face painted.
That they
yeah,
used? Maybe I should bamboozle them with that. No, I get along very well with the students. One thing that I do is, I treat them with respect. I don't ridicule them. I don't browbeat them. I don't threaten them or anything like that. I question them. You know. And I think they appreciate that, and my relationships with them through the years has always been quite good.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. At least, you know, 33 years, you better be having some fun. You know, the one thing
let me just add one other thing. I think there's something very attractive about anyone who approaches whatever it is they're dealing with passion. You know, you have passion in what you're doing. I mean, you could probably patent it and sell it at Walmart or something like that. But, you know, you have a passion for this stuff, and people appreciate that, and they respect it. And, you know, I don't care if it's flower arranging or what. If you just really put your heart and soul into it, people respect that. And
I'm the Richard Simmons of freedom.
Well, you know, I don't have to get up and dance. But, but it's that. It's the sort of a genuineness of it. You know, Mark is this way. We talk about Mark. You know, he's got a passion for this stuff. I mean, if you're going to be led to the gas chamber, Mark is going to be, you know, going to walk you right up to the door.
If you demonstrate passion for something like this, that's a good product. I mean, you know, that you want to share with people, that you're enthusiastic about it, that you know you're going to be appreciated for doing, you know, for sharing with your friends, your family, your neighbors. If you know that, it's easy to be passionate about it. If you're being passionate about something that you're just, you know, kind of, you're just selling it, well, then you're just a salesman. Then you're a huckster. Then you're an infomercial, you know. And
your passion, I think it reflects a sense of wholeness. That someone says you can't feel that strongly about something without it really being wholly integrated within yourself. And I think when people see that, you know, they take notice of it. It's like, you know, if you can live the completely kind of integrated life, and that's what integrity means, the completely integrated life where what you're doing in the outside world and what your spiritual or emotional values and everything else are, how you deal with other people, how you raise children and so forth, there's consistency in all of that. People, I think, kind of wonder why. Well, what's he up to? There's something, Leonard Reed, who I've always regarded as the modern father of libertarianism and who, by today's standards, would certainly be a conservative. But Leonard Reed wrote a book on elements of libertarian leadership. And the essence of it was, if you really want to promote this, this kind of a philosophy, you be the kind of person that your philosophy represents.
You know,
in other words, you live that way. You don't stand on boxes and yell out to people things that you don't really believe in. You be that person.
You know, you said integrity comes from an integrated life. You know, I never even, you know, the definition of integrity. I mean, I kind of, you know, kind of get this, you know, general sense of what you're talking about. You're like not a bad guy, you know, but, you know, then I looked.
I mean, you haven't been caught in a crime. Well, really, isn't that what it is? When you say this person lives with integrity, what does that mean? For most people, that means he's not a criminal.
Or caught.
Or maybe he is, but at least he hasn't been caught at it.
Well, you know, I looked up integrated, combining or coordinating separate elements so as to provide a harmonious, interrelated whole. And I'm going,
arrest my case.
I'm going integrity, integrated. I get it, man. Very good. Well, let me go ahead. And I want to share this one thought with you. And we had Art Laffer, you know, the infamous Laffer curve. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He came to the Valley a few years ago. The Goldwater Institute had him come. We covered him. Pal and I went and covered him and wrote about it for Freedom's Phoenix. We traded out, you know, our tickets to go and so on for advertising, promoting it. And we're like, yeah, whatever, cool, we'll do that. And we go. And they don't want to trade out with us anymore because when we write about these guys, you know, they're expecting us to be supportive and flowery. And we give a liberty. libertarian...
You mean you weren't a flack?
Right. So we give a libertarian perspective on this, and it came down to this one thing. The Laffer Curve is all about, you know, if you have, you know, 0% tax on anything, well, of course, the state's going to collect 0%. If you have 100% tax on something, well, you're going to have 0% because nobody's going to do anything. So there, he's going on about how, you know, this curve, there's a maximum revenue for the state having a certain amount of tax, most you can get out of them and then still be productive. And you can't do one big tax. It has to be a bunch of little taxes on like every single aspect of life. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going, well, that didn't sound very freedom oriented. You know, maximum revenue for the state. How about maximum freedom for the individual? I mean, I'm just doing, you know, I asked him that. And I go, you know, I raised my hand and they call me and I said, well, Mr. Laffer, I just want to know, why is your goal to have the maximum revenue for the state? And he goes, well, so you can spend it.
Yeah.
And that was, and you're talking about your institutional and individual economist, and you have the things that can't be quantified, like you got in Auschwitz. How do you have economy? I mean, you know, of course, the state made a bunch of whatever. They had free slaves, you know. So yeah. This is, and that's his, the mentality at a different level. He's going, look, it's just farming. We have people as livestock. They're human resources. We're trying to find the maximum way that we can take this commodity and turn it into the most productive thing for the collective, and they're trying to use him as a conservative. Well, they're trying to, you know, make him out to be some great Reagan bastion of liberty conservative thing, and I'm going, heck, he's just as sinister, heck, as not more so than the rest of these guys.
Now, this is why modern liberalism and conservatism are
the same.
Two wings of the same bird of prey. Just advocating the same process for sometimes different programs, but for the most part, what's the magic word that these people always like to have? Bipartisan. Bipartisan support, meaning a one-party system.
It means left jackboot or the right jackboot or the jackboot on your throat party. That's what it means.
Oh, exactly. You know, there was something I wanted to get back to because I made a note on this way back when this kind of first started. That kind of really supports some of the questions you've been asking here. It related to a commercial that you had for Survival Seed Bank.
Our names are not on that list.
Huh?
Our names are not on that list.
Well, one of the things that was said in there is, you know, don't be dependent on others. And I think that's the key to a lot of this. And I think about that in relation to the Amish. The Amish, I've always had great respect for the Amish. They are, when people say, can you really have an anarchistic type of community. Well, go look at the Amish. Of course you can. They don't have any political structure at all, and they are obedient to the state only when they are physically required to be so. But one of the things that they do, and people misunderstand this, they are reluctant to bring in technology into their community, not because they think it's the work of the devil or anything like that, but because if you bring in technology, you run the risk of having your community become dependent upon the people who produce and maintain that technology. So if you bring in automobiles, suddenly you're going to have to be dependent on oil companies, people who make batteries, people who make tires, people who repair cars, people who do all sorts of things. And, you know, they don't want to do that. And so when someone within the Amish community suggests, you know, bringing a particular technology into the community, they'll sit down and examine it. They'll talk about it. And I think this is something we all need to learn, and that is that we become attached to institutions, don't we, in various ways, our job, you know, the government, the schools, or whatever it may be. We have an attachment to that. We identify ourselves by reference to those attachments. And it just breaks our heart, you know, to see any of these attachments be threatened with collapse, with bankruptcy, whatever. You know, we just got to keep pouring more and more and more money and more and more and more liberty into these institutions because that's who we are. You know, that's who we've identified ourselves with. That's what needs to be broken. And one thing that was very interesting, and this is another thought I just want to throw out. I was watching program on one of the PBS stations the other night, and I was stunned to see this. It was a series called Justice, and it's conducted by a professor, Sandel, I believe is his last name, at Harvard University. And he was talking about libertarianism. And I thought, well, I'm going to watch this and see what the Harvard University take on libertarianism was. He had it solid. He had it solid. And they were talking about taxation, and he just took it step by step by step by step and came to the conclusion, taxation is theft. Taxation is slavery, because you have, you're forced to do certain things in order to pay your taxes, and it's...
Well, did he make the conclusion it was necessary theft, lesser of evils, or any of that crap?
No.
So we got a Harvard guy on PBS doing an accurate representation of libertarianism and coming to the conclusion taxation is theft.
Yeah, and or actually, taxation was slavery. I think that's his approach to it. But he was doing this in a class of, I don't know how many students, it's one of the big auditorium classes.
And, oh, I know what you're talking about. I've seen that on YouTube. He has a series.
Yeah, yeah. It's called Justice.
Oh, I remember
that. He is perhaps the most popular professor on the Harvard University campus. Now, what does this tell you? Here's Harvard University, the sort of the hallmark, if you will, of statist learning, having somebody who's able to do that. And he had asked people, after he developed this libertarian perspective, he said, how many of you agree with that?
Michael Sandel.
And that's it, yes. And I would estimate that most, maybe 10% of the kids in the audience kind of went along with it. The rest of them mostly rejected it. So he took some of the kids who were supportive of it and, you know, went out and talked with them about specific programs and so forth. What about this? What about that? These kids knew it. I mean, they followed the argument here. The only drawback that I saw in their comments had to do with they were still supportive of the idea of democracy, which I, you know, maybe they'll outgrow that, but it was encouraging, you know, that.
Well, I'm gonna put this up on today's archive. I got it. It's justiceharvard.org, and it has, you know, his blog that has, you know, episode 1, 2, 3, 4. Episode 1, part 1, the moral side of murder. You know, so it's just cut right to it. And, you know, hired guns, you know, for sale, motherhood, the supreme principle of morality, mind your motive, a lesson in line, deal is a deal. I mean, you know, I remember seeing some of these, the young kids that put them up, and so I know what you're talking. I'm going, oh, and he finally made it to PBS. Well, isn't that interesting?
But you have to do it. And he was not taking some doctrinaire, in your face stand on any of this stuff. He's just asking it as questions, which is, I think, the way you do this. This is what I do with my students. You know, just bring out a series of questions. What about this then? If you're going to advocate that, then what are the consequences of that? And just put them in a place where they have to think about it.
Now, this is, you know, a lot of people don't, I don't think they see what you and I see, the inevitable march toward this kind of thinking, because it's the only thing that supports, you know, I remember I read a book back in the early 90s. It was called It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand. You remember that book?
Jerome Tichilli.
And what it was is it just kind of, you know, gave a history, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about. You know, yeah, I did this and it started with that, and I went to this meeting and I met this person and that kind of thing. And I remember the big giant debates and discussion, I guess, in the late 60s, early 70s, right around the time of creation of the Libertarian Party and so on, which has its own issues. But you can't, you know, espouse individualism inside a government-sponsored collective. I mean, you know, that's begging for trouble right there. But the what it was—
I have a humanitarian form of execution.
Good point. So what they were saying was something like this. They go, you are anti-life. And then we don't have enough time to get into it right now. But when we come back from the break, I wanted you to go ahead and define what that meant. You know, they're saying you're anti-life, not to be confused with the pro-life, pro-choice kind of, you know, I guess you could make some, you know, corollaries. But it's to be anti-life was to be what? And what's to be pro-life from a philosophical libertarian standpoint? And it may even be the reason why the anti-abortion people kind of, you know, took that, because it has such a powerful meaning to libertarians. Are you anti-life? But we're going to find out when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and law professor Butler Schaefer.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Hey, we're back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. I want to get right back to Butler Schaefer, law professor in Southern California. I want to make sure that we get right to this life, anti-life. You know, the whole reason I had you on, we'll get to it in the afternoon, was in repudiation of the debt. And I just asked you that real quick. Is it going to get repudiated one way or the other anyway?
In fact, it will, yes. I mean, it's just much the same way that when the Soviet Union came into power, the old Russian debt was simply rejected, repudiated. The same when the Confederacy fell, you know, all the Confederate money became worthless and so forth. And I think what will happen is it'll get to the place, kind of like where you have with people's homes, where the debt on the home during the big bubble that we just went through, when the debt on the home became greater than the value of the home, people walk away from it.
Yeah, there was a skit. Yeah, we'll talk about it, you know, this afternoon. But there was a skit Jon Stewart did that was basically like, you know, we're just going to skip out on the debt, go to another country, and then sneak back in, you know, as an illegal immigrant or something.
Yeah.
But go ahead, the anti-life thing, what does that term mean? Where does it come from?
Well, life is, and I think this is part of the philosophical, the moral, the ethical, the spiritual, the emotional level that we really need to get back to. And this is what I was getting at in this talk that I gave on the cost-benefit analysis of the human spirit. We need to be able to talk with the rest of the world in ways that aren't just institutionally oriented. To me, life is associated with the notion of self-ownership. It's associated with the notion of liberty. Why do we value liberty? Why is it important? Because the Declaration of Independence says so, because John Locke said so, because Murray Rothbard and others have said so, or is it because that liberty is the condition under which life flourishes? You know, this need for spontaneity, for resilience, for individual autonomy, to be adaptive and to be flexible. The old observation that, you know, a tree does not grow from the top down. The idea that somehow or other we can run life in a vertically structured way with some people at the top making decisions for the living beings elsewhere in the system. And you see this in the contradictions of you know, like the pro-life people and the pro-choice people and so forth. Neither of them are what they say they are. Pro-life people are not pro-life. Pro-choice people are not pro-choice. Ask a pro-choice person whether or not they think the taxpayers ought to have the choice as to whether or not to support the various governmental programs that they favor. Oh, no, you got to have that. Well, I see. So you don't advocate choice in that area. The pro-life people, the same contradiction. Oh, yes, we love life. We're very much in favor of life and so forth. Good. What's your position on the war? What's your position on capital punishment? How can you pretend to be pro-life when you're advocating capital punishment and wars? Oh, blah, 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 blah. So these are people who parade around under labels that have no substance to them when you start examining them.
So when you say you're anti-life and they start bashing you over the head, some libertarian in a cat fight in the corner, what they're saying is that you're anti the liberty that supports the life that you say that you support.
Yeah, not just supports it, but is the essence of it.
The essence of life.
Take a look at any other form of life, animals, plants, and so forth. How do they behave? Even bacteria, viruses, have a self-sustaining purpose of their own. We humans come up with antibiotics to deal with some of these bacteria and viruses, and what do? They adapt.
We need to adapt. And Butler Schaefer, of all people, calculated chaos. You know, that's how we did life. It adapts. Well, institutions don't. So guess what? In the end, we win!